calls for an investigation into Jack City Hall. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the Duval Democrats want an independent investigation into Mayor Lenny Curry's office. We'll find out why in a moment with your calls. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, why the Jacksonville Civic Council is weighing in on a half-cent sales tax push for local schools, plus Cole Pepper with the latest on the Jags preseason. All of that ahead. But first this morning, the Duval County Democratic Party is calling for an independent investigation into the actions of Mayor Lenny Curry's office during the city's Stop the Violence initiative. They want to know if the mayor's staff exerted unlawful pressure to give special treatment to groups applying for crime prevention grants. Duval Democratic Party Chair Daniel Henry here is in studio to explain the party's position. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being with us. What are your thoughts and questions about calls for an investigation into Jacksonville City Hall? Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Okay. Let me begin by asking you. Critics of the Democratic Party locally say it was MIA in the last election, didn't even run a candidate to face off against Mayor Curry, who won re-election. Why are you stepping up now?
I think that's a good question. And to be honest, Melissa, I became chair of the Democratic Party literally 4 hours before qualifying. So if I could find a candidate in that short amount of time, I would have. But I took the mandate of the last 4 months of that election to focus on all the other races that we were focused on. City council is particularly important, as we're seeing right now. And we wanted to engage our Democrats to ensure that we are electing more of us to city council, but also starting a new conversation as to how we can set the direction of the city.
The controversy at City Hall currently has to do with revelations, according to the soon-to-be ex-head of the Kids Hope Alliance, Joe Peppers. He claimed in a written memo that he was improperly pressured by Mayor Lenny Curry's top staffers to award micro-grants for crime prevention programs to favored churches and groups rather than going through the legal procurement process. Why does this merit investigation, in your view?
I think it goes directly to what people are really sick about politics right now. And to bring it locally, I think a lot of people have kind of chuckled the way this administration has conducted its actions as transactional politics. But to us, it sounds like corruption. It sounds like procurement fraud. It sounds like they're trying to buy influence and try to steer money to organizations that they're particularly invested in or the political supporters are involved in. So we want to make sure that the taxpayer dollars that are being spent on these types of microgrants, that let's remind ourselves, were started because of the quell of violence that we were seeing in our city last year. And we're still seeing today with the 100th murder that occurred a couple weeks ago. So it's really important to ensure that the $364,000 that was invested in these types of microgrants are really being brought out to actually quell down the violence that we're seeing in a lot of our communities. And I think the citizens of Jacksonville deserve to know that their money is being spent in a way that's actually going to solve the problem.
It's 549-2937 to join us. You're calling for the local state attorney, the Office of Inspector General, the U.S. Attorney to investigate.
Right.
Is that politically feasible, given that State Attorney Melissa Nelson has ties to the mayor's top wingman, Chief Administrative Officer Brian Hughes.
Right.
His consultant ran her campaign, or his partner, his former partner, I should say, ran her political campaign.
Good.
The Inspector General's office, according to the city, is investigating the man who allegedly blew the whistle on this, Joe Peppers. We don't know the specifics of that investigation yet.
Right.
And so how can you feasibly expect an investigation given this state of affairs?
Well, and let's unpack that and piece by piece. The Inspector General of the city, someone that we voted into office to actually investigate these types of issues, the whole purpose of that office was to investigate certain irregularities that people or citizens or employees of the city may see are suspect. So we are happy that the fact that she's investigating this issue, particularly when you're talking about Joe Peppers, who, frankly, if we're being honest, got the position in very dubious situation in the first place. But you're right when you're talking about State Attorney Melissa Nelson. She does have a conflict in this issue, but I think she should take the same approach that she did with Matt Shirk about 2 weeks ago.
The former public defender.
Exactly, by referring the case to another circuit's state attorney.
You think she should refer it to the nearest circuit and investigate the mayor's office or a more broad-based investigation?
I'll leave that up to the investigators. I think what we have in the body politic right now with what we're seeing in the news is definitely suspect when you're talking about Brian Hughes and Sam Moussa, with some of the words that they used in the memo that Joe Peppers wrote last year and tried to memorialize some of the actions that he was saying. So I think it's very important that she follow her duty. She swore an oath to make sure that the laws were faithfully executed within this circuit. And if she's going to do the same thing when it comes to Matt Shirk with the irregularities that he was doing the last couple of weeks of his administration, she should do the same thing with this case.
What's your response to the perception many hold who observe local politics that there will be no investigation, that too much pressure would be brought to bear on anyone that tried to mount an independent investigation, that certain players might fear retaliation if they were to proceed with an independent investigation?
And that's what we kind of asked for, that multi-agency investigation, when you're talking about the inspector general, the state attorney, and the U.S. attorney, who ultimately the latter would have the ability to focus on this issue without any kind of undue influence that a lot of people are seeing in the other two investigations. So we need to look at this. I think the city is not immune to criminal investigations into our public leaders. We've seen that consistently over the past 3 years by the U.S. attorney specifically. So I think we need to focus on the fact that this is something that needs to be investigated, needs to be looked into. And regardless of whether or not we've kind of accepted the type of politics that we have now, I don't think the citizens of Jacksonville have accepted that.
We'll go to your calls in a moment for Daniel Henry, head of the Duval Dems, as they call for an independent investigation into alleged corruption at Jack City Hall. It's 549-2937. How would you characterize the political culture of Jacksonville, Florida? A minute ago, you called it transactional.
Right.
Describe that.
I think a lot of people make decisions based on what they can get from it, unfortunately. And that's not to say that public service is something bad. I'm someone that advocates for public service. We should look up to the leaders that represent us at every level of government. But I think what we're sadly seeing is what's getting most of the attention is some of the decisions that our leaders are making, and whether or not they've made them in the good intentions of the city or whether or not they've done it to their own political benefit.
Okay, let's go further too and examine some text messages that were public record and were released last Friday. Action News Jax obtained them. Messages from Chief Administrative Officer Brian Hughes' personal cell phone going back and forth with Joe Peppers, the erstwhile CEO of the Kids Hope Alliance. Mm-hmm. According to these text messages, Hughes directed Peppers to give certain grant applicants money, in particular Bethel Baptist Church, which is a powerful political player in this city. The text said, Bethel going to need a micro grant.
Right.
Okay, that's one thing. Another text message that's gotten a lot of attention was a profanity-laced exchange between Hughes and Peppers as they were talking about City Councilman Garrett Dennis. He's right. Been an outspoken opponent of the mayor's office. Hughes referred to him with an expletive.
Right.
And so he has since apologized and given a statement about this, saying he's embarrassed to have used profanity. What would you say to those who've looked at all of this and said, this might be unseemly conduct, this might be embarrassing conduct, but I don't see a law broken?
I would say and challenge a lot of the things that we're seeing in those text messages, the first of which, when you're talking about Bethel's gonna need micro, Joe Peppers himself acknowledged that he saw that as a directive, not a suggestion. And frankly, the KHA, the Kids Hope Alliance, was set up to focus on issues and try to quell violence across the city of Jacksonville. So much so that the mayor saw fit to make sure that it was under the direction of his office. So the idea that an independent executive director of an agency is getting a text from the mayor's chief of staff saying, Beth are gonna need a micro. How else should he take it in the sense that that's a directive that they wanna make sure that that organization gets a micro grant? And going back to some of the choice words that the now chief administrative officer of the city used to refer to a city council person, frankly, I think it's disgraceful. He is someone who right now is one of the most highest paid city employees of this government. He is someone that's responsible for the day-to-day operations of this entire city. And the idea that he joked around with Joe Peppers at the idea that he was an expletive. And why should he talk to this person? This is someone who was elected by the constituents of District 9. This is someone who represents thousands of citizens that live in the Jacksonville area. And at the end of the day, the mayor and his administration, they took an oath to protect and defend the laws of this city and this state. They have a constitutional obligation to interact and to correspond with city leaders at all crosses of the level, including city council members. And what we saw in those text messages kind of opened a window that they choose who they want to correspond with. And I think that's very troubling.
It's 549-2937 to join us. On our Facebook page, Susan writes, a friend of mine that writes proposals for nonprofits seeking grants told me the city's explanation about all of this is bogus. Let's explain how the procurement process is supposed to work when you're doling out taxpayer money in the form of grants for any initiative, whether it's crime prevention or something else. There is a process that needs to be followed. Allegedly, Mr. Peppers was concerned that it wasn't being followed, which, depending on which legal expert you talk to, is either an ethical violation or possibly a violation of the statutes.
If you think about it, Melissa, he was so concerned that the process was not being followed that not only did he go to an attorney in the general counsel's office, not only did he write an email to himself memorializing the events that occurred that September last year, he made the point of sending that to some of his direct reports in the process, thus creating a public record of the event. I said this earlier, he was way under his head. He shouldn't have been in the position in the first place. And I think with the conversation that has occurred this past week, we've seen one side of the argument. The mayor's office is trying to give the other part of the argument, but what we're trying to say here is this whole thing seems unseemly and seedy. It doesn't give anyone a true comfort that the proper process was instituted and was followed. And at the end of the day, if it comes down to one question, it is, why would the mayor's chief of staff, the mayor's chief administrative officer, sit down with KHA CEO Joe Peppers and say, this is family, this is political, when referencing these micro grants? That's not something that seems like it's an honest process. That seems like procurement fraud to me.
Ann tweets the show, why wouldn't the FBI conduct this investigation instead of another circuit or district attorney?
Well, that,
I think she goes on to say, I think what Curry, Musa, Hughes et al. Is doing violates RICO laws.
Right.
Okay, now she's referencing the RICO statute, racketeering.
Right.
Saying the feds should look into this. What about that? Is there standing to do that or not?
Well, the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Florida has jurisdiction to look at any issues that she feels are appropriate. And we are in the Middle District of Florida. If this office felt that they needed to look at whether or not there's procurement fraud or RICO charges that should be investigated, they would have the jurisdiction to do so. And obviously they'd be working with the FBI to conduct that investigation.
And have you reached out to the U.S. Attorney's Office, the State Attorney's Office, the Inspector General's Office?
We plan on doing that later today.
You're doing that today.
We are.
Okay. Have you spoken with Bethel Baptist Church or any of the other agencies that were allegedly due to get some of these micro grants?
We have not, but at the end of the day, I don't think we're in the business of investigating whether or not there are certain issues with these grants. I want to make sure that no one could accuse us of trying to tamper the process. It's an obligation of these law enforcement agencies to look at these issues, and that's what we're asking them to do.
Some local Democrats have alleged that these grants were being directed to certain politically powerful faith leaders so as to tamp down any opposition they might have had leading up to Mayor Lenny Curry's reelection. What's your position on that?
I think we should look at this without, this didn't happen in a vacuum. If you got to come back with me, this violence happened at the beginning of last year in January and February. This is around the same time that the mayor's office was dealing with an onslaught of the potential of selling JEA. Further along with that, in September, we were still dealing with these issues. The conversation was really getting to a boiling point, and the mayor's office wasn't in a position of power. They're really dealing with a lot of issues at the same time. So when you look at some of the actions of Brian Hughes and Sam Musa trying to ensure that these certain organizations were getting micro grants, it kind of goes with the theme of power, money, and corruption. They wanted to ensure that their critics were quieted. They want to ensure that organizations that supported them were getting money. And that's not a knock on the work that these organizations are doing within their communities. I'm sure that they're trying to do the best they can with the resources that they have. And trying to get money from the city is not necessarily a bad thing. The whole purpose of why these micro grants were created were to try to solve a problem. The issue comes with how they were awarded. People expect this government to dole out taxpayer dollars fairly. And if there is any accusation, any suspicious actions that we see in the public, now we're seeing the newspapers, that this money was given in an irregular way, I think law enforcement agencies have an obligation to look at it. This can't be something that gets quieted under the rug.
How dedicated are you to ensuring that there is an investigation? As I said at the outset of this discussion, there's a fair bit of skepticism that an investigation will ever commence.
Well, and as chair of the Democratic Party, I would say we're fighting for the soul of the city. We're fighting for the soul of what the citizens of Jacksonville feel in these issues. And at the end of the day, people may be cynical about the way that politics are run in Jacksonville. But if we don't change that, if we don't challenge that, if we don't ask questions, then how do we expect politics to change? The best scenario for a lot of these leaders is for this investigation to go away, for us to start talking about something else and quickly change the chapter and they can move on from it. But the past 2 months of this administration, if you think about it, we haven't gotten to 100 days yet. And we're dealing with investigations. We're dealing with the possible sale of JEA. We're dealing with the half-cent sales tax and their obstruction of that. A lot of things are happening in this administration. I think they feel emboldened to do whatever they want. And the only way we can stop that is to ensure that we try to be a roadblock or to ask questions to prevent them from doing so.
Daniel Henry chairs the Duval County Democratic Party. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, Culpepper checks in on the Jaguars preseason. But up next, the Jacksonville Civic Council weighs in about that proposed half-cent sales tax for schools. That's right after this.
What can $9.90 get you? Access to the very best in science, nature, and history docs. Introducing WJCT's newest member benefit, PBS Passport Plus Curiosity Stream. Now for the first time, you can get access to all of the great documentaries on PBS's Passport and also get access to the incredible collection of Curiosity Stream, the new documentary service created by the founder of the Discovery Channel. A $9.90 monthly contribution gets you ongoing access to both Curiosity Stream and PBS's Passport service. It's a member benefit unlike any we've ever created and available only from WJZT. Sign up today to get all the documentaries you love anytime, anywhere, on any device. Passport plus Curiosity Stream together for $9.90 per month.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. The Jacksonville Civic Council is weighing in on the push by the Duval County School Board to get a half-cent sales tax referendum before local voters. Right now, we welcome CEO Jeannie Miller. She heads up the Jack Civic Council. Joining us by phone, the council's task force head on education, former State Board of Education Chair Gary Chartrand. Jeannie, Gary, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. It's 549-2937 to join us. Jeannie Miller, let's start with you. The Civic Council has released a statement about how funding should be allocated for both public and charter schools in Jacksonville as the school board pushes for a half-cent sales tax referendum to improve, repair, shore up aging schools. Let me ask you about your response to critics of the council's position. They perceive that you're both trying to weaken traditional public schools and also enrich the coffers of charter school owners or those that are allied with charters, some of whom are part of your membership. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, thank you, Melissa, for the opportunity to be here. And, you know, first I would say that the Jacksonville Civic Council was formed in 2010. We are honored and blessed to have 82 CEOs from around the region who participate, who are members. And they all have, while they have their industry subject matter expertise, they also have subject matter expertise in their areas of civic engagement. So, and many of those individuals also have philanthropic interests, like in education. But the Jacksonville Civic Council identified two main strategic objectives in 2017. Those objectives were a high-quality K through 12 education system, and our public finance, looking at the state of our public finances in Duval County. So as far with regard to K through 12, one of the things that we embarked on was literally a broad-based study with the Hastings Fund on examining the role of charter schools in Duval County, and really not just charter schools, but all schools, recognizing that not every student learns in different ways, and that students have different needs. So, in working on that particular report, we determined that there is a need for charter schools, and that there's a need to support charter schools locally. So, as with everything that we do, we start from a fact base and evidence, and then we move into discussions, recommendations, and negotiations. So, we are fortunate enough to have folks who have, like Mr. Chartrand, who have excellent subject matter expertise, and we are focusing to make sure that every single student, public school student in Duval County, has the same access to facilities that are safe and clean and that have covered walkways and athletic fields and auditoriums and gymnasiums.
Gary Chartrand, let's bring you into the discussion. The Civic Council is calling for tax dollars from this referendum to be given proportionately to charter schools. Critics of that approach have pointed out that the referendum is need-based, that the idea is to shore up some of the oldest school buildings in Florida. They've said that if the referendum is doled out proportionately to charters, that the charter school management companies, many of which are leaseholders, would actually stand to rake in a disproportionate share of public money. And they've pointed out that these newer buildings are in less need of this kind of repair funding. What's your response to that?
Well, Melissa, thanks for the question. There are lots of ways to define need. Yes, charter schools perhaps are a little bit newer, but they don't have all the amenities because they've been underfunded for a decade now. And this is data that goes back actually from the annual report from DCPS. Over the last 10 years, charter schools have received 57% less funding for facilities than traditional schools. So there is a real need on the charter school side. And our position is that every child that attends a public school, charter schools or public schools, should benefit from the tax. And quite frankly, I just want to make sure we're clear on this. We are for the tax. We do believe that we need great schools in our community. The number one reason people leave Duval County or don't move to Duval County is education. And so we believe that a system of schools, as opposed to a school system, which would be high-impact charter schools as well as great traditional schools, is the right answer to a world-class education system.
A few weeks ago, we hosted on this program School Board Chair Lori Hershey. She opined that she felt both city officials and business leadership, such as the Civic Council, are being heavy-handed about this fight. Let's listen to a short excerpt of Hershey. Here she is.
Well, I would say it feels more like extortion as well as being held hostage. The question that needs to be answered is, will the voters be able to decide, and if so, when?
Okay. Jeannie Miller, what's your response to the school board chair saying she senses that both city officials and business groups that are aligned with those officials on this issue have placed undue pressure or have used heavy-handed tactics on this matter?
Well, number one, I will say that I had not had the opportunity to actually meet with Chairwoman Hershey until just a few weeks ago, and it was after her appearance on the show. But I'd like to go back and say that Dr. Green was invited and came to speak to the Jacksonville Civic Council membership in January of this year. The council membership and the Education Task Force made clear the importance of charter schools in an integrated school system, a fully integrated school system. And then again, in a private meeting with Dr. Green in March, I reiterated that the same sentiment of the Civic Council, we want to help, we want to facilitate and contribute. At that time, we did not have any specifics on the plan, but we offered our assistance, and we reiterated that the importance of charter schools. Then again, in April, at the beginning of May, we sat down with Dr. Green, some of her staff, with Mr. Chartrand, and some of our staff to again reiterate our desire to work with them amicably to incorporate charter schools to ensure that all students are funded equally. So the suggestion that I can't speak for city officials, I can't speak for other people in the business community. It's always interesting when someone says they, because you just, you know, it's a group. But I can speak for myself and the Civic Council, and no one has proposed even a single number. No one has proposed a single amount. What we've asked for is a formula and a way to sit down at the table and work through every single one of these issues. We thought it through, and we believe we can bring the benefit of our expertise to the table.
Let's go to your calls now for the Jacksonville Civic Council. It's 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. I was wondering, I'm so happy to have this opportunity to ask this question. If the charter school, which is housed in a building that is privately owned, is sold, what happens to the profits? And since we've got Mr. Chartrand on the phone, and he's heavily involved in that CHIP school, so if the charter school were sold, that CHIP school, like, and if he could maybe give you some links and stuff so we could verify what he's saying, because I've looked on the Florida Department of Education.org about charter schools, frequently asked questions, and they clearly say that the only thing that will be returned to the school board, to the school district, is property owned by the school district. Well, the building that the CHIP charter school is housed in is not owned by the school district. So to ask us to use our sales tax money for funding for buildings that aren't owned by this school district seems not a good use of taxpayer money. So that's my question.
Okay, Susan. Gary, why don't we get you and then Jeannie? And by the way, we're getting tweets about this too. Here's one. This is and always will be about profit. Old white businessmen, I'm quoting here, don't put charters in poor neighborhoods because they care about the kids. This is about money. What do you say to critics of this whole fight who perceive that this is about real estate and money rather than the education of children?
Melissa, that comment is absurd. Myself and a bunch of other community leaders about 10 years ago saw a need in Northwest Jacksonville. We recruited the KIPP schools to come here. KIPP is a nonprofit, and by definition, a nonprofit is owned by the community. We don't expect that that school will be sold. It can't be sold. It's a nonprofit. So that's an argument that for the nonprofit sector is just does not hold water.
Gina,
by the way, if those kids were not in the charter school or KIPP, they would most likely be in a neighborhood school and would be funding those neighborhood schools. So that's an absurd argument. Thank goodness we have a lot of good people in Jacksonville that are trying to do something about education. A lot of private dollars were raised to support KIPP. This is not about profits. This is about making sure that kids get a quality education.
And I would just add to that, Susan, thank you for the call. And it's a question that we've received and several folks have raised. It's a good point. But first, let me say that the district school board leases buildings currently. It leases several buildings, in fact, for its school choice office. So currently, state funds are going to enhance, if you will, private landowners. But that aside, if, as Mr. Chartrand mentioned, if it is being utilized by a nonprofit, then it is literally a bit, you know, it's one of the assets of the nonprofit. But what we're suggesting and what we've said in all of our documents is that there should be, the district should add appropriate clawback measures so that if the school goes out of business, if there is some problem, if the school doesn't use the funds as it was intended, there should be a mechanism for the school district to either take the property, take a lien on the property, or to get paid back. So we've proposed that, and we think that would be a fair solution.
Let me ask you as a follow-up, Jeannie, why has the Civic Council been so vocal on this issue of education and your critics say has been quiet on other important issues, such as privatizing JEA, for example? Why not weigh in on some of the other issues that have really roiled this community in recent months?
Well, if you recall, over a year ago, we formed a JEA task force, and we are continuing that work. That task force is in 18 months of work. We've engaged experts. We're actually engaged in updating an expert study. So we will weigh in on that. But as I said, as I started out with, we start with facts. We start with research, and JEA has been a highly complicated situation, particularly given the fact that the sands keep shifting under our feet.
Gotcha. Lots of emails coming into the show. Here's one from a listener. I am beginning to wonder why Mr. Chartrand is fighting for more money for charters when his school receives more than any other school. $9.6 million, that's the amount the KIPP school actually owes Gary Chartrand and another member of the Civic Council. Chartrand might claim he is fighting to get charters more money, but it looks like he's fighting to get paid. What about that allegation that's been levied against you, Gary? You have put a lot of money into the KIPP school. Do they owe you money? Is your zeal to direct more funding toward KIPP in part due to, your critics say, wanting to get some of your investment back?
Well, as you know, I've invested heavily into the education sector, Melissa. When we started a KIPP school, the dog track where it is now, the former dog track was donated to us. It needed about $10 million worth of repairs to retrofit it. There wasn't a bank in town that would lend us money. And so John Baker and myself, in the statement of the KIPP owes me $9.6 million is not correct. But John,
how much do they owe you?
There's, I think right now, about $2.5 million. But it was a PRI loan. Nobody would lend us money. There's a philanthropic loan structure that allows you to loan money at below market interest rates so that you can actually have the funds to be able to build out the school. And that was a philanthropic effort. And I really think that people that criticize people in town that are philanthropic with education, is also I think, off bounds.
So this isn't about you wanting to be made whole from Kip then?
Not at all. This is about making sure that everybody understands that public charter schools are public schools, and the children that attend those schools are public school children, and that they should be treated just like any other kid.
Let me ask you both as a follow-up. When Lori Hershey was on this program, she expressed the belief that this push for proportionate funding for charter schools is less about the current charter schools in the district and more about the ones that are slated to come into the district within a couple of years. The so-called Schools of Hope align charters like the IDEA charter school chain that looks to be setting up shop here in the future. What's your response to the criticism that you're trying to pave a trough for money for future charter school presence in this community?
Well, if I could start, you know, the first, Mr. Chartrand makes a good point. It is very, very difficult, if not impossible, for charter schools to find funding, particularly if they're going into a low-income area. So they have to rely on the minimal funding from the state, which is traditionally 57% less than district funding, and potentially, you know, philanthropic funds. So, but as far as future funds, if you look at, and we have reams and reams of data, that there is a current need with charter schools, and I can't tell you how many charter school principals I've spoken with who are reluctant to come forward, are reluctant to say anything because they believe they are concerned about, because they have to be reapproved every so many years by the district. But the need for funding, for some level of funding for these public schools, is real. It has been real. I have 10-year graphs that can show you the decline in enrollment and the increase in enrollment and demand for charter schools, which means, frankly, that more parents are staying in Duval County, which is what we want.
Let's go to Chuck in Bartram Park. Hi, Chuck. Thanks for holding. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I guess my question would be, because there was a statement made that the charter schools have been underfunded for the past 10 years. One question is, how long has it been since the Duval County schools have been underfunded? Because I think it's more than 10 years. And if we would have done a good job of funding those public schools back then, would there be a need for charter schools? And number two, this is more of a comment. Remember that the charter school systems are for profit. That's a big difference in an education.
Well, some of them are, yeah. Some of them.
Yeah,
some of them.
Most of them. The majority not
most of them.
No. Okay. Chuck, I hear your point. Okay. Jeannie, what about that? Go ahead.
Chuck raises a great point. And I think this is where a lot of the public, you know, the school system is incredibly complicated. But first, let's start with the funding premise. The Duval County Public Schools today receives 1.5 mils that is strictly committed to operations. So last year that was $99 million, $99.6 million, and I think it's projected to go to $108 for next year. So on a per student basis, that turns out to be $963 per student for Duval County traditional public schools. For charters, on the other hand, relying solely on state funds, the average is $478 per student. So I think part of Chuck's question has to do with why past school boards or past, you know, school groups did not move forward with a funding measure. That could be debated ad infinitum. But we are where we are today. There's no question that our district schools need help. And our suggestion is all public school students should have the benefit of this tax. The money follows the child. Once the money is in the district's hands, if the district decides that certain schools need more assistance than others, then they can make that decision. But as for charters have always been funded per student, and charters will be funded per student so long as those funds are used for facilities. The district then can direct all of its funds based, again, on its total enrollment and in whatever direction it needs. So if certain schools have a higher priority, then those schools would get the priority.
Lots of emails and tweets. Meanwhile, here's one from Savannah. Charter school kids are public school kids. They deserve the basic amenities in their school as well. Charter schools keep parents here in Duval County. Here's another point of view from Ira. Your guests are killing public schools by diverting public school funding to privileged schools that often violate the separation of religious intent with public education. Okay, let me direct that one to you, Gary Chartrand. There's two points of view there coming in on our social media and email. Let me read a couple of tweets too. Here's one from Jimmy. He writes, funding shouldn't be allocated based on criteria the Civic Council dictates. No doubt they can exert their outsized influence in Tallahassee, where these decisions are made. What we all need today is the City Council to set a date for the referendum. So on the one hand, the argument Jeannie made is echoed by some folks out there. They think robust charters will keep the tax base here in Duval County. On the other hand, you're being criticized for trying to apply, in their view, outsized influence on this whole debate. How do you respond to that?
Well, outside influence. Look, we have a civic organization that's has a voice in our community. We're participating in the democratic process. I have several letters, actually, on email from Dr. Green asking for input. They've been around the community asking for input. We're giving her our input. And to come on your show and say that this is extortion, which is a crime, by the way, is not fair. We're giving our well-thought-out input. We've researched this. We've put it all in writing, and we're participating in the democratic process to try to make the plan as good as it possibly can be for all children in public schools, not just those kids that actually attend traditional schools. And if you look at the data over the last 5 years, 1,000 children per year have left the traditional system to go to the charter system. So there's a need. Obviously, parents are speaking with their voice and their feet. And so what we believe is that a robust, world-class education will be a combination of a system of schools, of traditionals, high-quality traditionals, which we're for. We are for the tax. We want the schools to be great, but also high-quality charter schools as well.
Let me follow up on it. We're getting several emails from listeners about the religious piece. Granted, that's not really a big part of the fight here in Duval. But that said, let me ask you, Gary, because you are perhaps the most prominent advocate on this issue in Northeast Florida and even have a statewide reputation. During your tenure as chair of the Florida's Board of Education, you did champion funneling taxpayer dollars not only into charter schools, but also public voucher funds towards schools that have been scrutinized at the national level for teaching academically dubious and sometimes scientifically inaccurate curriculum. An Orlando Sentinel investigation called Schools Without Rules found that public funding went to thousands of students who were taught that dinosaurs and humans lived together, that slaves who knew Christ were better off than free men who did not, that the earth was 6,000 years old. We're talking nearly a billion in taxpayer funding. How do you justify that?
Well, first of all, that's a totally separate issue from what we're talking about.
I realize that, but it goes to your credibility as a champion of educational excellence.
Sure. Let me defend that.
And we're almost out of time. Sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Step Up for Students was put together back in the Jeb Bush administration to allow very poor children that don't have choice to have the ability to go to a private school. The voucher has been given to them. It's actually so that they can have choice. I don't agree with any kind of religious issues that are taking place there. That should not be allowed to happen. But I do believe in choice, and I do believe that kids that don't have the ability to move or to go into a private school need choice. And that's why I supported the Step Up for Students Scholarship Program.
Gary Chartrand, Jeannie Miller, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Underwater explorer and photographer Jill Heinerth has dived into unmapped caves deep in the earth and beneath a giant iceberg. She's seen hidden creatures old as dinosaurs and witnessed scenes of surreal beauty. Her work is so dangerous, 100 of her friends and colleagues have died in dives. She has a new book, and we talk with her on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Deforestation in the Amazon rainforest has soared since Brazil's far-right president took office in January.
Every time you look at a satellite image of the forest, you see another little piece is missing.
That's bad news for the planet's climate. The forest stores vast amounts of carbon. A trip into the Amazon this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
In the 1980s, archaeologist James Dunbar helped to prove that people and mastodon coexisted in Florida nearly 15,000 years ago. Today, he's making similar discoveries at Wakulla Springs. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with James Dunbar. We'll discuss Florida ephemera and the Spanish mission system. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Cannabis remains illegal in parts of the country, but a medicinal chemical within it is fueling a new industry. Products with CBD promise everything from better sleep to fewer seizures. These businesses could add billions to the economy in the next few years, but does this compound really work, or is it more trend than treatment? CBD 101, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it looks like we'll finally see the real Jaguars in the preseason.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper's here. He's been dropping in on the team. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, we have not yet seen the starters in mass play for the Jaguars in the first two preseason games. Doug Marrone said last week that he didn't want to risk the offensive stars in the preseason unless the offensive line was healthy and intact. Reed also wants to protect Nick Foles. Well, it looks like that line is ready to go, and that's certainly good news for those of us who want to see the offense show what they're going to look like during the regular season. No offense, Gardner Minshew, but let's see what Nick Foles can do. Even if the preseason game is only a preseason game, it's not just the fans who want to see Foles and the rest of the starters out there. It is important for the coaching staff to get a look at everyone before the regular season begins. The starters aren't likely to play in the fourth and final preseason game, so Thursday will be their only chance at a dress rehearsal down in Miami. I asked Foles yesterday if he had some anticipation for the first and likely only preseason game in which he'll play.
Getting into a game is where, you know, that's the most important thing. But, you know, right now the anticipation is just, you know, getting to the film right now and watching practice and, you know, staying in the moment, working on today. And then, you know, you do that every single moment, every single day. Then the game comes and the game's not as big as it would be as if you sort of focus on it right now, you know, because then the emotions get way too high, way too early. Instead of like, all I got to worry about right now is we've put all the work in so far today. Now we're going to watch it. We're going to take notes. How can we improve? And then we're going to come back tomorrow and install more stuff and do the same thing. And then, you know, by game time, based on what coach decides, we'll be ready to roll. And all we have to do is go out there and plays called, execute it, stay in the moment, play for one another.
So where you are right now, do you feel like you've got a good grasp of where the offense is, even without having that test in the game? Do you, like today as we stand, you have a pretty good sense of here's where we are right now?
I'll go off today and practice, you know, where we are. You know, I felt like we had a really good practice of executing, you know, the game plan that's in right now. I like the game plan that's in. I felt like we did a nice job today. I still, every day we need to continue to improve because we're a young offense. So, you know, there's never going to be a time where we arrive. We still have a lot of work to do each and every day to fine tune our blocking, our route running, our footwork, every single thing. You know, so we still have a few weeks to prepare, but, you know, we still have a lot of work to do.
All right, so far we've seen only six players who are listed as starters play in the preseason. That means that 16 have not played out of the starting 22. At least 13 of those should play on Thursday. Here's what I think we're going to see on Thursday. The Dolphins are not very good, and I think we'll probably see the Jaguars offense go right down the field, score a couple of times. By the time the starters are pulled out, Jaguars will be up 17-3 or something, and everybody's going to be thinking, this team's going to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately,
we can dream,
hey,
right?
Look, go with it. Enjoy. It's the preseason, after all. The Dolphins are not the best test imaginable, but it's what the NFL schedule makers made for the Jaguars. So if something different happens, I think we're going to have to reassess. I really expect very good offensive performances by the key players against the Dolphins. If they don't have those, you have to start asking, has this preparation approach that Doug Marrone has taken really worked? After all, they're going to open the season against a Super Bowl contender in the Kansas City Chiefs.
Okay, let's talk about high school. High school football is up and running this week. Yeah, it's already happening.
Here it is, our first football Friday. And by the way, also Saturday, we have a full slate, including a triple header on Saturday that we're broadcasting live on Channel 4. Lee against Bartram Trail, then Mandarin against Atlantic Coast, University Christian against Bulls. This is an interesting season, to be sure. A lot of teams have changed their classifications, including Reigns, the two-time defending 4A champs, now going to 5A. Trinity Christian, one of the best teams in the area, down to 3A. They should dominate in the playoffs, but they have a schedule like I've never seen before in high school football to deal with before they get there.
Well, hopes for a great season for everyone. More football to talk about. It's football all over the place. College football and arena football. You're tracking a couple of college football games this Saturday.
Yeah, there are only two in what they call week zero. And one of those games is Florida against Miami. That'll be played in Orlando, the first college football game of the year. Going to be interesting to see how Dan Mullen's team does in his second year. They had a 10-win season a year ago and could be a team to contend in the SEC East this year. And indoors, the season has come to a close with the Sharks winning the National Arena League Championship. They did it on Saturday night with a touchdown with 7 seconds remaining to beat the Carolina Cobras. Mm-hmm. It's the second time that the Sharks have won the National Arena League in 3 years, and it's also the third championship overall. They also won the Arena Bowl back when they were playing in the AFL. So the Sharks champions once again, cue Freddie Mercury.
That's right. So this is the time of year when guys like you don't get a lot of sleep or time off.
Yes.
We just need to point that out.
That is true. And, you know.
And you've got a baby on the way.
Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons I won't be getting a lot of sleep. But
I could get you some 5-hour energy, some Red Bull. Maybe I should have that for you every Monday.
I think I prefer a clone, actually. That might be make things easier. I'm probably the first parent to be to say that.
Clone
but,
Pepper.
Yeah, exactly. But it's going to be fun. And having the season kicking off the way it is in high school and college this weekend really gets things kicked into high gear. And of course, the Jaguars opener just about 3 weeks away.
That's right. Catch Cole every Monday on this program. Watch him every night on TV on Channel 4, our news partner. Thank you, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. We value your feedback. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, a conversation with Jacksonville City Councilwoman Joyce Morgan on the revitalization of Arlington and other measures. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for music. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.